All right, how are you doing? It's Matt here. You listen to episode 228 of the Looking Sideways Action Sports podcast. It's a show where I look at life through the lens of snowboarding, skateboarding, surfing and other related endeavours. Big thanks for tuning into this episode and I hope you enjoy it. It's pretty much 7 years to the day, actually, since I put the first episode out. So that's a nice little milestone, isn't it? So today's episode is with snowboarder, activist and Just Stop Oil campaigner Callum McIntyre. Now this one does require one of those, all right, so you've not heard of this guy, but you should really listen to this episode, disclaimers. I mean, I'm pretty lucky in that after 7 years of doing this, the great Looking Sideways public does tend to take my word for the guests that I have on. But I did a survey on Substack recently where I was asking people to give me some feedback, and that made it quite apparent that there is a big constituency out there who are basically like, I really miss the old days when you used to interview Jamie Thomas and you didn't focus on all this woke shit. Sorry lads, what can I say? There was also a big constituency like, I really miss Type 2, what happened to that? I mean, all I can say is like, this entire thing has basically always been a vehicle for me, very self-indulgently, to explore issues that I find interesting. And this is where my head is at the minute, very possibly because I've spent the last 12 months immersed in these themes while I make my forthcoming documentary series, podcast documentary series, I should say, the announcement for my pals at Patagonia. The other thing is as well, when I started, there wasn't really anyone else doing this. These days, there's millions of podcasts out there in ye olde action sports realm, either doing the whole immersive interview with the stars thing, hello Bombhole, or the tedious Stephen Bartlett life hack yibble thing. I'm not going to name any names, but they're out there. And Callum, to come back to the point, has an extremely interesting story. So we first met back in March 2019 or February 2019, we can't quite remember, up in Lofoten, which I'm going to mangle many times during this episode, in Norway, on this snow camp that Patagonia had organised. I think there's about 30 of us. Really good laugh, that. And we stayed in touch ever since. We shared a room, actually, and we've become really good friends. And it was Callum who wrote what is officially my most popular Substack blog ever, last year's thought-provoking piece entitled 5 Reasons Why Our Community Does Not Engage, in which he was gently and politely, because he's always polite, critical about the way our community pays lip service to the idea of climate change or climate action, but generally shies away from any kind of activity that is actually going to A, require any type of personal sacrifice, even on the most basic level, and B, is actually going to be effective. So me and Callum have been discussing these themes on and off ever since, whether over emails, messages, chats. And I've watched with interest as Callum has become more and more immersed in the world of direct action, primarily through his association with Just Stop Oil, the environmental campaigning group you've probably heard of and you probably have an opinion of, to the point that he's been arrested and in court a couple of times, I believe, over the last few months. And he's been, again, extremely politely using these personal experiences to gently challenge, once again, the apathy among, well, everybody about the fact that our right to protest is being eroded in the UK, something which he is directly experiencing as a result of the recent legislation that the British government has been quietly bringing into law over the last few years. And all of which made me think it would be a great time to have a chat with him about all this stuff. In this, I was quite influenced by the reaction to last year's interview with Nick Hayes of Right to Roam, which I think it is fair to say split the listenership straight down the middle. For everybody who wanted to be in Nick's gang, and that's definitely a thing if you see it on Instagram, there was an equal number of people who were basically like, Christ almighty, this guy's a student. And you know, that is the challenge with this stuff, really. Like, as I'm beginning to think about and understand more and more, the point is really like how you communicate this stuff. Like, everybody has their own opinions about this. And Nick Hayes was, I mean, he was like super articulate and, you know, very, very clear on what the goals of that group were, and obviously campaigning in a pretty effective way. But he didn't seem that bothered about bringing the majority with him. And I just think that's really interesting. And, you know, it's also been informed this by my view about this whole purpose industry, as I call it in this episode, full of, you know, self-titled change makers. and how I'm just beginning to wonder if that is the most effective vehicle for actual change. So this is the conversation you're about to listen to. Huge thank you to Callum. I thought it was super interesting and highly thought-provoking, and that's the entire point of all this, right? You don't have to agree with it, but it's just about kicking the tires and actually asking a few questions, which is what I'm trying to do with this whole gig. So I'll be back at the end, but here's me and Callum. Direct action. Enjoy. How are you, man? You've been splitboarding.
Yeah, I had an awesome day, actually. It was one of those days where expectations were kind of low. And it was like a new valley for me anyway, and a good friend. But it was, yeah, perfect snow and just like an amazing day. So it was
nice. And where, so you're in Norway, obviously, but I don't really know where you are. Like, so whereabouts do you live?
Yeah, not many people know of this place. It's kind of funny. I'm going to blow it up now, probably. It's called Sogndal. It's like the west coast. It's about 3 hours east of Bergen.
Okay.
So it's a funny town. I came here originally because there's a university here, so I studied here.
Right.
But it's like a funny town because it's like sort of a season air place, but then it has a university, so it's like a bit different. You know, it has people stay on and do like proper jobs.
Stuff. Yeah. It's how big is it?
7,000 people. So it's pretty small.
Okay. And but the mountains are obviously kind of proper, right?
Yeah, they are. I mean, they're like, in my opinion, I think this like some of the best riding in the world here, to be quite honest. It's just so varied. You have high mountain, like alpine stuff, 2,400 meters, and then like really good forest riding, and
yeah,
just everything really. That's kind of why I've stayed, because it's just so varied. So, you know,
well, from your Insta stuff, it always just looks like you've got this little corner of the snowboarding world to yourself. because you obviously you're a really good snowboarder, and some of the lines are great, and I always look at it and think, you know, it's like if Scotland got really good snow, isn't it, you know, like, and had really good conditions, you know, you'd probably be in Scotland, right? Like, but yeah. I always look at it and think, fuck, he's got a right little good thing going on there. He's, you know, like, because quite often there doesn't seem to be anyone around, like when you're riding, like, or it looks like you can find decent lines and solitude really quite easily, which is so rare, isn't it? It's kind of the dream, you know.
Yeah, no, there's no one here. It's crazy. And I was like joking to my friend today, because the place we went today is like an hour, but like the other direction from where we normally ride.
And right.
I was like, God, man, we got to the top of this peak, and then we're looking out, and I was like, oh, I'm going to have to stay here for another 10 years. You know, there's like 10 years more riding. Yeah. It's crazy. There's just so much to do here, and it's really very little people are discovering it.
And so does the wider snowboard world know about it? Do you get like people doing trips, or like, because you know, like that whole, hey, we're going to go, like, you know, that trip we did to Lofoten. How do you say it? Lofoten, Lofoten. I never know. I should know. Yeah. You know, there's the whole like, hey, you can surf and you can, like, I'm guessing it's quite, is the waves near you? Like, it must be quite a, you know, for that thing, it's probably quite a goer, right? You could probably like do a trip, surf, like do some good riding. Like, is that a possibility?
Yeah, for sure. Like, Stutt is quite close to here. I don't know if you know that there. Yeah,
I've been, and it was fuck. I went 10 years ago. I went August, 14. And we went the next valley. We went to Hodavika, is it how you say it?
Yeah, Hodavika.
And it was devastating. I mean, it's beautiful, but it was devastating. Like, we got there because I was supposed to write about it, and they were like, because it's those camps, like, I think they're Norwegian camps. They've got a surf camp, and they were just like, yeah, you can bring some people if you want. So I ended up going over with like four friends on the camp, And we got there the first day and it was probably like waist high. And then it literally went flat and it was completely flat. And it was fine. Like we went stand up paddle boarding and hiking and stuff, but it was pretty frustrating because I was like, fucking hell, this place looks like it'd be amazing. Like if it had proper swell, but like completely beautiful. So how far is that from you then?
That's like three, four hours. So you definitely can do a trip, but now we don't get many people coming through. There's a few, like a lot of the like big Scandinavian riders come through, but it's not known at all.
Yeah, because JP Solberg's got a place in Stadt, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Well, he used to have anyway. And then, God, what's the other guy called? Surfing. Yeah. He's got a place, hasn't he, as well?
Yeah.
Like, and they ride up there, don't they? Because I've seen stuff from those boys up there. Yeah. So that's how you ended up there, because that's what I was going to ask you. So you went to university in the town and then you just stayed.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit funny. Like, I was on a road trip here with a friend in, when was that, 2015? No, 2016. And then we just came through this town on the last day, and I sort of, like, we had a really good day and then drove through and I noticed there was university. And they actually, like that week had kind of launched this new program on climate change management, it was called, very broad. And it wasn't actually open to, like, people from outside Norway, but I just kind of, yeah, persuaded them to let me join it.
Right.
Here.
Nice. So that was the
point. Yeah.
So let's talk about, so we're obviously friends and we've been chatting a lot over the last sort of 6 months. So we met on that Lofoten, I'm just going to apologize in advance for how I'm pronouncing that, which I think was 5 years ago now.
Like, yeah, it must have been like 2018.
It was pre-COVID. 19? It was the year before COVID. And that was the Patagonia snow camp thing that we did, wasn't it? So it was me, like we shared a room, didn't we? It was me, you, Lauren was on it, Dan was on it, Alex, Yella. It was interesting, wasn't it? Like it was a kind of, let's all sit around and talk about what the industry could do from a direct action point of view. So we met then and I just started working on Type 2 at that point. So it's now, and then obviously we've stayed in touch and become friends and have been, you know, we've been chatting a lot really, haven't we, over the months about, like what we've been chatting about is kind of like action, isn't it? Like what action looks like, you could say, couldn't you? You know, because obviously you're really involved in direct action, let's call it, through Just Stop Oil, which is one of the things I was really interested in speaking to you about today. And then, so tell me about what's been going on for you in the last few months then. So you've just been, yeah, tell me about that, like the court case, like getting arrested, like the Just Stop Oil protests. Tell me about that. Let's start with that.
Yeah, so I mean, I've been involved in Just Stop Oil in Norway for like a year and a half or so, and have done quite a lot of actions with them. But then I was in London in November, and I just sort of decided to go and, like, it was a bit just showing, like, to be honest, I was just a little bit, I felt like I, you know, wanted to show some solidarity kind of with the people in the UK who are doing this kind of stuff. And I joined a couple of just protests, like, you know, just slow marches on the road.
This is Just Stop Oil as well in the UK?
In the UK, yeah, in November. So, yeah, I joined that in November and basically got arrested twice then. And it was all quite dramatic, you know, like held in the cell for 24 hours and a very different experience to what I've experienced in Norway anyway. And for me, that was also interesting to, like, I'm interested in how the police are dealing with this kind of stuff and like how they're repressing climate activists, especially in the UK, because it's like much, much harsher than in Norway. So
yeah.
I was interested in that. But basically I got arrested a couple of times and then had to go to court then. And then basically I just now had to go back to the UK for a court case. That was last week, which was for willful obstruction of the highway. which we won, which was very nice.
Well, I mean, congrats for that, because I imagine, even though you, when you were telling me about this previously, you were, I'm not going to say blasé about it, because obviously you weren't blasé about it, but you seem to take it as part and parcel of, if you're going to engage in direct action, like particularly in the UK, you should probably expect to get arrested, especially if it's around climate. So you were, philosophical. There was equanimity about the way you were sort of talking about it, but I imagine it was pretty fucking stressful. So, congrats on that. So we'll talk about the fact that that's, like you say, the intersection of this whole quite draconian approach to protests that's going on in the UK right now, which is obviously linked to like the kind of death throes of the Tory government and like the kind of culture war stuff and all that. Like we'll come back to that in a minute. But so what was your experience like then through this? Because did you expect to win the case?
No, to be honest. I'm just going to turn my phone off. Sorry.
It's all right. Everyone does that.
No, to be honest, like I was not very optimistic because, you're in the magistrate's court, so you're basically just at the, it's the luck of the draw. If you get a cool judge or not, basically. And there's a lot of cases have been, a lot of cases have been getting found guilty. And a lot have been also getting dismissed or being found not guilty. So I didn't really know what to expect, to be quite honest. But it was like the judge was very, very harsh on us, actually, like the first day, especially. So I did not have my hopes like high at all.
Harsh in what way?
Just being very, very strict with us. And like, it just felt like she wasn't really on her side,
Sorry to jump in, but like, you were arrested for literally slowly walking down a street, right?
So on the 21st of November, it was basically like a slow march from Trafalgar Square down Whitehall, which is like home of the government. And we're holding a banner saying just stop oil. And it's basically like demanding the government stop giving out new oil licenses. And I was on the road for 2 minutes and 47 seconds exactly, and then like the police cleared us off the road, arrested us all, held us for 24 hours. And the thing is that I think, like, what I don't know if you want to talk about like the kind of repression and stuff in the UK, but it's sort of interesting.
Please do. That's one. Yeah, of course. I mean, it's on topic right now, this, isn't it?
So like I got arrested for, it's called Section 7, which is the new Public Order Act, which came into the force like last year, which was basically to deal with Just Stop Oil. That was why it came into force.
Yeah, that's why I kind of mentioned it in reference to the culture wars. Not a phrase I'm a fan of, but it'll do for this conversation, because the right in the UK is obviously, well, actually that's unfair, because I think a lot of the general public are pretty down on this type of direct action, aren't they? So it feels like for politicians who, are looking for an easy populist win, then this is a pretty fertile ground, isn't it, to sort of say, look, we're taking action on these pests, basically, because they've been doing it with like Insulate Britain as well, haven't they? And like, anyone that's like basically engaged in this type of direct action protest around the climate is getting caned, to be blunt, right now. And that's through this new legislation that was brought in last year specifically to deal with this, you're saying?
Yeah. So basically, like, they and the reason they brought it in is because what they can do is basically issue like a Section 7 order for a whole area. And that means that as soon as you step onto the road, they can arrest you. And so like before, with the previous before they would use this willful obstruction of the highway law, and that there's lots of like things, steps they have to go through. They have to, when you're on the road, they have to say, okay, you're causing some disruption, I'm going to give you a warning. If you don't follow my warning, then you might be liable to arrest. They have like a 5-step kind of process they got to go through. But with the Section 7, they just basically it's like a blanket order and like everyone can just get arrested like as soon as they're onto the road. So that's what happened. But then like the interesting thing is that when I was in the cell, like I got woken up in the middle of the night. That's what they do, you know, they wake up at like 2 a.m. and then I got charged with something completely different, which was willful obstruction of the highway. So they charged us with the 1980 like Public Highways Act. And I mean, this is like speculation, but I think the reason that they charge you for the Section 7 is because that has to go to the Crown Court.
Right.
And so that's a jury trial, much more expensive. Sure. And, you know, if a jury is hearing like that you've been walking on the road for 2 minutes and 47 seconds, it's most likely they're going to find you not guilty. So I think that's the reason why they were like ending up charging us for this like lesser, this willful obstruction of the highway charge. So yeah, I went to court for that basically.
And you got a cool judge in the end. As you put
seemed
it.
Like, I think we also presented, we presented a pretty good argument, you know.
What was your argument?
Well, I used this case from a couple of years ago. There was a arms fair and some people did a protest outside and they blocked a road. And it caused quite a bit of disruption, a couple of hours of disruption to like normal traffic and stuff. And basically it went like all the way to the Supreme Court.
Right.
And it's called the Ziegler case. And the Supreme Court basically found that these people, it's in line with the European Convention on Human Rights, that a protest, you know, can cause some disruption, basically. So we just used all the different, there's like different points from that case. So I just went through those points and said, like, you know, the disruption was in a targeted place. The protest was obviously like nonviolent, completely peaceful. It didn't promote like disorder. We were like cooperative with the police and all of this, basically these different points.
Was it tempting to try and make it political about like, because obviously one of your concerns, which is what I'd like to ask you about next, is, and you've hinted at this, is what this says about the erosion of civil liberties and the fact that our right to peaceful protest is being like quite systematically eroded. And to be clear, it's been eroded, you know, it's the 40th anniversary of the miners' strike, for example. And, you know, that was obviously like a key bump in the road, if you like, around that. You know, there was legislation again brought in at that point, wasn't there, to give the police more powers to like break the strikes and all that stuff. So there's an arc of this, particularly in the UK. Like the UK is I think draconian for a Western liberal democracy when it comes to protest, and you can really see in the kind of language that politicians use right now, it's like it's really weaponized, isn't it? So that is obviously, I've seen you make that point on Insta. You know, you're basically saying like, why is no one more concerned about this? Like, you know, forget my politics, forget my cause, forget Just Stop Oil. And again, we'll come back to that point about direct action and its effectiveness. But what your contention is, like, you might want to protest peacefully one day, and what this is saying, my experience is proving that this is actually getting harder and is getting, you know, made illegal, essentially. So I'm guessing you didn't raise that in court because I'm not sure that would do you any favors, right, with a judge. Like, they're not, I imagine that. But that's the question. Did you, is it tempting to frame the argument in those terms, or did you just talk about like, actually, I'm just going to try and get off and I'm going to be really specific about the case?
No, I went super hard into that stuff, actually, in my defense.
Right. And how did that land then?
I mean, I don't, it's hard to tell, you know, but I have a feeling it was like, it went down okay. I mean, the point I brought up was that there had been, in February, there was like the special reporter from the United Nations. He launched a report. He come here. He'd been in the UK in October, I think. And he wrote a report, which was basically all about like the repression that climate activists are facing. And he said, you know, in very clear terms that this was like a, you know, a total threat to democracy, basically, that peaceful climate activists are facing like so much pressure and so much repression. So and the thing is that he is like representing this thing called the Aarhus Convention, which was something which was, it's like a UN convention which was brought in 1998, I think, and the UK signed on in 2003. And it's basically a convention to protect like environmental defenders. So I brought that up a lot actually in my defense, because I think that the UK is like breaking the conventions of the Aarhus Convention. So I brought up that a lot, and I also like was quite clear that I thought it was very concerning that individual police officers were, it appeared that they had basically been just given like a blanket order to arrest people without, because they're meant to be trained in European Convention on Human Rights and like how to deal with protest, and you know, is it, they should be able to judge like, is it causing a lot of disruption, should I arrest them, da, da, da. But it appeared that they had just been given like a blanket order to arrest, which I think is pretty scary. So yeah. I brought all that stuff up. Yeah,
right, interesting. Because I think the thing is, you're extremely articulate about this, and you're really even handed about it. Like, you don't fit the kind of stereotype, I guess, of like the gobby protester who's, you know, the Citizen Smith, let's call it. Do you know what I mean? Like the kind of agitator, because that is an archetype that again is weaponized in this conversation, isn't it? You know, by the press, by the government, by elements that want to make political kind of hay around about this conversation. So yeah, that's why I was interested in that, really. But
just to add on to that quickly, like the thing is that, I mean, the other people that were like on trial with me, you know, it's like a previous advisor to BP. It was someone that had spoke at like a COP conference. It was, you know, people that were pretty like on top of things. And I found that really interesting. It was,
yeah,
it was, I just think that people have this impression of protesters. And I think that comes from the media, you know, especially. Yeah,
that's why I use the word archetype, because it's, yeah, it's not often true.
Really. No. So it's, yeah, I just think it's important for people to realize that. Yeah, it's definitely like people have an impression of protesters as this certain type of person. And I just, yeah, totally like, yeah, it's not true at all.
So why do you think there's such apathy around protests? Like, one of your stories the other day, you know, you were posting about, I looked into it. It was again, Just Stop Oil protesters getting quite randomly arrested, wasn't it? They weren't even protesting. They were literally getting arrested at home. Some of them, they were getting arrested, and it was all filmed, and they were, and it was, it seemed like it was all coming from a Daily Mail story. Like it seemed like basically there was a Daily Mail story that had insinuated that some of these protesters had been involved in a burglary, right? So these people were getting arrested by the police, like, you know, like, so they weren't even out protesting. It was like almost like they've gone out to just kind of take them off the street, if you like. And you were again making the point, like, this is really insidious and alarming. Like, you know, basically the police are with seemingly no evidence, seemingly based upon press stories, are out there preemptively arresting climate protesters. And your kind of point was like, why is nobody bothered about this? So what do you put that apathy down to? Like, why do you think nobody is interested in this?
I mean, I think one major thing is it's not really in the media. Like, I don't see many journalists actually. I haven't seen really any stories about those people getting basically arrested off the street on their way home from dinner. And I find that, like, I don't understand why that isn't an interesting story for like mainstream journalists. But I also think that, yeah, I just think that this, like, the idea, as I just said, like the idea and the image people have of like activists or protesters is just so warped that I think most people just assume that they've, you know, that they're like, have been doing bad stuff, or they've, you know, is like they deserve to be arrested. So I think that's like a big reason. And it's all, you know, it's like, I think what people don't really realize is what goes on in the background, that this has been a plan for the fossil fuel industry to put money into think tanks and stuff like that, which can put stuff out in the media, because this has been happening all across the Western world, like in the last year or so, like climate activists being portrayed as eco-zealots and eco-terrorists and this kind of thing, because it just basically, that is the point, that when then those activists face repression, the public just don't care, because they, you know, they think that they are like a menace to society.
Well, I mean, it's not even like the public don't care. I mean, there's been cases of like the public like attacking people, haven't there? And, you know, like actually. So yeah. on that note, then, like, why? I'm going to ask you a very, very obvious question, which wouldn't be the first time I've asked one of these. Why is this important? Why should people care?
I mean, it's like what I was saying on Instagram. I just think people, you know, maybe you don't care about climate change, but when you have something that you think is very important and you don't think the government is doing enough on, and you want to protest, these laws are already in place that stop you from protesting. And I think that is just really, really dangerous, you know? And I just don't think many people really understand, they don't understand it. And so I think it's just really important that people actually, I mean, like, it does seem that Just Stop Oil, for example, and climate activists in general are facing, like, they're facing the worst repression now, but you never know, you know, like, you never know in the future who else is gonna face that kind of repression. So yeah, I don't know, I just think it's really, I think it's very, very frightening that they would, you know, politicians would go to these kind of lengths to like silence people just for speaking up about, you know, the climate crisis, which is something that everyone should generally kind of care about. And the other thing I think is a bit terrifying is that, you know, Labour, they went along with these protest laws too. Because a lot of people are saying, you know, oh, well, you know, it's fine. Labour are probably going to get into power next round election. It'll be all fine. But I'm like, no, I don't think so. You know, they haven't really spoken up about these protest laws. So I think that's very dangerous.
Further weaponizing this whole conversation, like the British government are now bringing in this definition of extremist, which is being sort of piloted by Michael Gove, I think, isn't it? And with some, like, the backing of some faceless group of civil servants, which is gonna, you know, mean that if you're defined as an extremist, which presumably like climate protesters will be, then you can also get the full weight of the law thrown at you, which is another like really alarming development, isn't it? Which, to be fair, is getting a lot of press and is getting a lot of pushback, I think, from civil liberties groups. And I guess my question on this is, what do you think is driving this from the government? Do you think this is a case of like politics for them? This is, you know, like we said earlier, there's an election this year. They're just trying to do anything they can to try and, you know, give them some relevance at this point. Do you think that's driving it, or do you think it's a bit more ideological?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both. I definitely think there's some, like, at least the, you know, the Tories, they want to be seen to be like cracking down on these annoying protesters basically before the election. And they see that as like a very easy kind of easy win for them, I think. But I also think, yeah, it's like a bit ideological, and they, you know, they're kind of tapping into this whole culture war thing, you know, by portraying climate activists and activists in general just as like dangerous people and, you know, the mob rule kind of thing. But I also think that there's just a lot of influence from the fossil fuel industry, which is driving this. Like, it's very clearly beneficial to the fossil fuel industry that climate protesters are repressed harder and harder and are made out to be these extremist type people in the media. So, and it's been documented that, like, the latest, I think I said this earlier, but like the last public order bill was drafted by like a think tank, which is funded by ExxonMobil, you know? So I think that's also just another factor, which not many people really maybe think about or realize.
Yeah. So one of the things that we've been talking about is direct action. You know, one of the sort of ongoing conversations me and you have is kind of like the range of protest. You know, one of the things that I talked about a lot on Type 2 was this need to kind of bring the middle ground with you when it comes to, you know, I guess like tipping point change, you know what I mean? Like transformative change. Like if you look back to the great social movements of the last 200 years, so let's just say like the end of slavery, universal suffrage, civil rights, to take three, you know, the pattern seems to be direct action, like, or even like something like CFCs, like the ozone layer, you know, like direct action is the initial thing. Like, you know, if you look at the suffrage movement, like clearly direct action was quite a huge part of that story.
Yeah.
And to the point that the government also introduced legislation at the time to try and stop that direct. I mean, the Cat and Mouse Act, I mean, Jesus Christ, like, you know, and then that, but that reached a point where that started to influence public opinion. What I would call, what I'm calling for the purposes of this, like the middle ground. And then once that middle ground is kind of persuaded, then it legislative change seems to follow, because obviously the government see it as a vote winner at the end of the day. So that pattern seems to like broadly, I mean, I'm sure there's people listening to this that know much more about this than I do that might be cringing at that pretty broad stroke description, but I think it's kind of fair for the purposes of this conversation. And what I'm always surprised at is how, like, how quickly people forget about the role of direct action. So I was looking at your Instagram post before we started talking. So it's a picture of you getting dragged out of a Norwegian football match, isn't it? And you obviously posted that to be quite provocative, really, because you were saying, you know, look, here I am being engaged in direct action and being dragged out of a football match. And the result of this was that we got loads of press. And, you know, there was an article about this, and that enabled us to, you know, you were like, there's a point to this. We're not just trying to annoy people. And there's a guy in the comments going like, basically like, you know, you're a pest, you're antisocial. Like, you know, the argument always is like, what makes you think that this is going to win people to your argument? So again, like, I guess our question would be like, why do you think people, because you obviously make a really good case for direct action. You know, you seem to historically, like a historically literate case as well. You see it as a big important part of this range of protests, as I do. Why do you think people have forgotten that, do you think?
I just think we're not, I just think really, really people just take for granted all of these rights that we have today. You know, I just don't think people really, you know, when you think about like the 5-day working week, I just don't think anyone really thinks about like, how did we get that? You know, it's not like people just asked nicely for that to happen. You know, it like,
well, kids going up chimneys, like, you know, exactly. Like child labor, like it didn't just stop magically one day, did it? You know,
no,
holiday pay, maternity pay, like all of these things, like all of those things came from protest, right?
And I just think we're not in touch with those, and we don't learn. I didn't learn about any of these things in school. I think that's also a thing. So I just don't think people appreciate that all of these things that we take for granted, like, weren't just given to us. And I also think there's something we've said. I mean, I have said this before previously, but you know, I'm pretty privileged, you know, and a lot of my friends are from a similar kind of background, or people I talk to are from a similar like kind of background, like born in the UK, and you know, I'm a white guy, and I think we just don't have the close experience of really having to fight for like something political in, you know, at least, yeah, like my my generation. And so I think that's also a big part. It's just not having this like closeness to it, you know? So for me, it was, I did a lot of reading and I was very skeptical towards disrupting the public.
A couple of years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. For sure.
Yeah. I did a lot of reading and a lot of, talking with different people and things before I started doing this stuff, because I was also skeptical. I didn't know.
Why were you skeptical? Because of that argument? Because you thought it's just going to annoy people?
Yeah, the same thing. Yeah. But I think what really impacted me actually was hearing about more recent campaigns, like, for example, like the campaign to it was called ACT UP in America around AIDS in like the 1980s. And like, it's so interesting to see how they used it, you know, they were blocking roads, they were doing really disruptive stuff just to get the issue of AIDS up the political agenda and up the media agenda. They just, you know, all they were trying to do was to get people to talk about it in society. And same with, like, for example, disabled rights in America, at least, like, they were blocking roads and doing, you know, they were disrupting the public. And I just think those examples from like a bit more recent history, they impacted me quite a lot, actually. And I just sort of really saw that, like, wow, this, you know, the things that we're doing today have been used in all of these like campaigns throughout history.
Yeah. So the point is, like, the phrase you just used is to get it up the political agenda. Like, how, like, it just to be devil's advocate for a second, though, it's still quite a blunt instrument, right? Because, like, if you take the case of climate, obviously 99% of the discourse around what you do as a, like, somebody involved with Just Stop Oil doing direct action is incredibly negative. Like, it's basically, again, like, look at these students, like, blocking roads, like, and try to enrage people about that. Like, how do you gauge what's the payoff against that, and actually, like, where does it start to work, where you actually get it up the political agenda and then start to change people's minds?
I think it's easy to think of it in, like, you know, over a couple of week, 2 week period where you see like lots of bad media attention or like, you know, articles and stuff. But I think it's important to think of it in like a more, you know, a couple of years perspective. And I've definitely noticed that with Just Stop Oil in the UK, for example, who've been going for, you know, a couple of years now. They started in 2022. For me, I was home in Scotland for 2 months over Christmas, and I was incredibly shocked to see how many people were talking about oil licensing.
Right.
And that's the point. Like, that is literally the point. I think it's very easy to see it just like, oh, there's just so much bad media attention and all this kind of stuff, but it gets people talking about the issue. And that is, I mean, in the case of oil licensing, that is what the oil industry have always tried to avoid, is like the public actually talking about what they're doing off the coast, because then they know, as soon as the public actually start talking about that and realizing what they're doing, then they're going to get regulated by the politicians. And so right. I think that's the point. But I do find it slightly difficult when you see all this bad press, and it's like, it is easy to think like, oh, is this really working, you know? And especially for me, when, for example, I did that like protest at the football game, like I got a lot of negative comments and stuff from people, especially in the ski community, and it was quite hard, honestly. I really had to, it was pretty difficult.
As in what, saying that it was the wrong thing to do, basically?
Yeah, people like calling me out and saying like, you're damaging the conversation, like people have been working for years to get climate more up the agenda in Norway and get people talking about it in a positive way and la 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 la, and you're just destroying that.
Right.
And it was quite hard.
Do you think there's any validity in that?
I don't think so. No, because for me, like, from personal experience, you know, like I know that all, of course, when I did the action at the football game, I mean, I had 30,000 people basically, like, you know, totally hating on me and, you know, booing. And of course they thought I was like the worst person in the world at that moment in time. But, you know, after, like, it's actually in my personal kind of circles, it's generated a lot of conversation. And, you know, we had a meeting in my local town, which is, you know, 7,000 people, like a week after that action, and 50 people showed up to talk about oil licensing. And like, I've never seen that before. And I've been doing this stuff for, you know, 7 years or so. So that's what I say to people is like, it's those 50 people who come to the meeting to talk about oil licensing who are going to change like society. They're going to be the ones that are changing the conversation. You don't need, you know, this is not like X Factor or something. You don't need to be popular. It's not a popularity context. It's a contest. You just need to get society talking about the issue.
Sure. But optics are important though, aren't they? Like, to use another hateful political term. Like, I was just struck thinking about, so I had Nick Hayes on the podcast last year. You know, the Right to Roam guy, and he was like incredibly polarizing. Like, you know, he's a public school educated, very privileged, and he really aggravated a lot of people. Like, because, and I, you know, some people like really buy into that whole approach to the way that they approach protest, which is a little bit dogs on strings, really. You know, it is a little bit like that. Like, I'm probably, again, going to have people like, you know, fuming at using a word like that. But it does come with those connotations, like, particularly in this country. Like, you know, I have bored people on here and on my Instagram ad infinitum about the kind of water protests in Brighton. And what was really interesting to me was like, so I'm basically in a surf WhatsApp group, you know, it's like 40 people or whatever. And I was texting people in the WhatsApp group saying, you know, there's a water protest, like we should go because basically like where we're surfing, like there's an overflow pipe and chances are we're surfing in shit, you know. And one of my mates sent me a picture of Swampy, you know, but was basically like, you know, was gleefully basically sort of saying like, sorry lads, I can't make that, I'm off to Wetherspoons, you know, like was really like, you know, was essentially like, I'd rather swim in shit to own the libs, you know, like, yeah. But that figure, that part, that this idea of that swampy like figure, like that kind of, you know, privileged person roughing it, like is quite a powerful totem in this world. And I kind of got the vibe from Nick Hayes that was like, a lot of people were a bit like, he just sounds like a student. You know, it just sounds like somebody who's just like, because in his book as well, he's talking about like breaking into these places and like, you know, smoking weed and like, and that's kind of fine, but like that is going to wind people up. Like that is going, there are some people that you need to win over that are just like, you're going to lose the argument before you've even started with that. Like, so it kind of brings me to this other conversation that we've been having, this idea of like, so I interviewed for my Patagonia podcast today, this guy called Erin Sahan, who's like business and enterprise lead at the Donut Economics Action Lab. You know, he's like, works with Kate Raworth as part of the Donut Economics organization. And he used the phrase, the purpose industry. You know, like it kind of does come back to this idea that there's this group of people that for whom it's just a bit of a jolly, it's just a bit of a thing that they do. Like, and optics are important. You know, it's kind of why I said earlier, like, you know, you're even-handed and articulate. I was quite mindful about using those words because it's important. It's important that you can stand in front of a judge and make a really cogent case for like why this is contravening kind of like civil liberties, rather than just being like, well, fuck you. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, so how do you balance that with the direct action thing? Because it comes back to what I was saying with like the 99% thing. Like the people in that stadium, like they were on the swampy tip, weren't they? You know, they were basically like, look at swampy over here, like ruining our football match. So like, again, how do you decide when to pull that lever when it comes to direct action and think about like, well, I'm actually alienating more people than I'm going to persuade at this point.
Yeah, it is a tricky question, but I think it comes down to to, you know, your communications afterwards and, you know, being articulate and definitely like not, I think like it's really dangerous if people like take lightly the kind of act of, you know, doing direct action. I think it, you know, it should be really, really taken seriously. And I think also, I don't think it's communicated enough, like how much so many of these people that are doing direct action and being put in prison and being arrested and all this stuff, how many other things that they've tried in the past.
Yeah.
I think that's an important point to get across. You know, it's like for many of these people, it is like, is a last desperate attempt to actually get the government to take heed and do something about this issue. You know, we have been asking for 30 years, you know, whether people can, you know, whether those in power can actually deal with this issue. And so I do think that's a little bit lost. Maybe it could be communicated more, I think, how many other stuff, you know. For me personally, I have done everything like that they tell you you should do, you know.
You've tried the middle ground.
Yeah, and I think I've done everything. Like I've, you know, doing all those like petition campaigns. I've done like the divestment stuff, trying to get my bank to stop funding fossil fuels. I've started like a business in my local town to reduce like emissions because I didn't think the politicians were doing enough. I've like worked for like a research consultancy and all this different stuff. But I don't know. For me, it was actually like a very powerful moment for me to be in court and feeling that like the pressure kind of like from the state, because I got this really real sense that this stuff works, you know. If they are putting so much resources and so much effort into trying to silence you and like repress,
changing the law,
exactly, yeah, like I really got a very powerful, it was definitely the moment, like definitely a moment where I felt that okay, I'm actually having like, I'm making a difference here. So
right.
I do think it's important for people to, yeah, to think of this stuff as not just the act of, you know, direct action. It's all this other, you know, it's like all the other.
Yeah, it's a really good point. Yeah. I mean, do you think that people's apathy around this stuff and like distaste for this stuff is reflective of their, of perhaps a wider apathetic attitude to the climate crisis? Do you think people have, because one of the things you said to me over email the other day is like, because I was sort of saying to you like, oh, you've gone full nuclear again. Yeah, because one of the conversations that we're exploring as we talk off the mic, just generally as friends, is like, you know, I'm sort of saying to you like, what does the middle ground look like for you? You know, like what would that look like? And you said something to me like, I just think this is so serious and it's just so important to me that like, but I, you know, that like the climate crisis, like is so real to me that like this, that like I feel like I have to act in this way. But I don't think everybody else feels like that, do they? Is that something, do you think that's a reflection of these wider attitudes towards like the actions that you take, the protests, that there's just not the same sense of seriousness amongst the public at large, if you like?
Definitely. I just think that most people just do not understand like how serious the situation is. Like for me personally, I think of the climate crisis as empty, you know, a supermarket with no food, like empty shelves in the supermarket. And I think that's like terrifying because, you know, if there's no food in the shops, like that means societal, you know, is chaos basically. And I think for many people, climate change is like this abstract thing, like, you know, polar bears in the Arctic and melting ice and, you know,
should we build a ski lift?
Yeah, like not too much snow in the future and la la la, this stuff. And yeah, I just don't think the seriousness is like really communicated to people in the media. And I think also people have been just desensitized to it. You know, it's like every day you hear this, oh, you know, we're passing 1.5 and, you know, forest fires in Europe and all this stuff. And it's just I don't know. I think people are desensitized to it. So, I mean, for me personally, like, I had a really big turning point. I think I've maybe told you about this before, but like, I was doing talks for the ski community in Norway, like around it was during COP26.
Yeah.
In 2021. And I was giving these talks around Norway, and I had this line in the talk, which was like, if we pass 2 degrees of warming, which is, you know, forecasted to happen, 1 billion people will face extreme heat stress. And then I was looking into like, okay, what is extreme heat stress? You know, it's too hot for people to live. And there's 1 billion people. And I just, by the time I got to the last talk that I gave, I was like choking up during the talk, because I just, you know, it was like, it just felt ridiculous kind of to be like giving this nice friendly talk to like a bunch of skiers and then having this line, which is like 1 billion people are going to face heat stress. And so for me, that was like a really big turning point.
But it's a tough sell. It's a tough sell, though, isn't it? You know, like generally the idea of like that, like what you're selling is, if you like, if I can put it in those terms, is not that palatable. You know, like it comes back to like the sort of communication point, because let's just look at the Bozell lift thing that I published on my Substack the other week. You know, like even that debate, obviously, like, in the context of what you're talking about, the most fucking privileged debate ever, really, like, because it was literally like, well, I might get to go up the mountain quicker, and, you know, about commuting and stuff like that. But one of the points that Gav Fernie Jones, who was arguing against the lift, was like, well, why don't we just have buses, you know, like, and Chris's point was a bit like, well, I don't really like getting the bus, essentially. I'm not sure I'd disparage Chris, because I actually agreed with loads of what Chris said in that, like, but my point is that it's just a really tough sell, isn't it? You know, like, I spoke to, for the announcement, I spoke to this guy, Branko Milanovic, who's a World Bank kind of economist. And, you know, he's like the kind of person that when I interviewed, I was a bit like, I definitely did have imposter syndrome. Anyway, he made the point, we were talking about donut economics. And he was like, my problem with this, it's just dishonest. Like, it basically paints this picture of the future, which isn't really truthful about what that would involve. Like, it would involve like a lot of people's standard of living dropping, you know, and that, like, now I know what you're probably like, yeah, but the alternative is worse. People are going to have like, you know, severe heat stress. Like, but you get the point I'm making, like, until that happens, it's conceptual. So you have to persuade people through stories. And like, he was saying, like, I just don't think they're not telling an honest story. They're not telling people like the reality of what this will mean. And you could hear a similar thing when Kate Raworth was on Leading with Rory Stewart and Alistair Campbell. And they, you know, they were treating her like she was batty. You know, they were basically like, what do you mean an economy that's not based around growth? Like, what are you talking about? Like, and really, because they're both a pair of like, you know, politico wonks, you know, they were talking about it in terms of like, well, we could never sell that to the electorate. Like, you know, you couldn't, you just couldn't sell that. So how do you sell this? Like, you know, how do you, because this is, again, something we've spoken about a lot, isn't it? Like, what's effective when it comes to this argument? And I'm interested in your view, really, because from what I understand, your view is that there's a lot of very ineffective communication around this stuff going on right now.
Yeah, it is hard, though. But I mean, for me, I definitely think we need to, it really feels like people are, I get the sense that a lot of people know that, you know, just this like endless growth, the economy is just going like up and up and up and up. It's just not, I get the sense that a lot of people feel that something is wrong, you know, that it can't really be like that. But a lot of people don't really know what to do. And there definitely needs to be like a cultural, you know, a transformation in what people value. But I don't know how that looks. But I know that for me personally, and I think it's quite interesting, because I got the sense that was what Gavin was talking about in that piece, where he's very much like, you know, we need to focus more on the community, like talking to your neighbors, being more in close contact with those around you, like where you live and that kind of stuff. And that's like, definitely for me, that's also a really big thing. And something that I actually like, I really get from this kind of like direct action type stuff, is that a lot of that is focused on building strong communities, talking to other people about the big issues, and, you know, inviting people to a public meeting and discussing stuff and seeing what we can do about it. And I think that's really, that's what we have to do, is just, yeah, talk to people. I think if you can really, you know, people are so influenced by the media and this whole kind of eco-zealots and climate change is going to, you know, it's going to cost you loads of money, and like climate change policy. But I think we just have to get better at talking to each other. And I think a lot, if you can actually explain to people the benefits of a lot of these policies, like living more locally and better public transport and stuff, you know, I think people would actually get them.
Is that like, what's this, what's it like in Norway? Like, how's the appetite? Because obviously Norway's got this, you know, you're talking about the fossil fuel lobby. Like, I imagine the fossil fuel lobby in Norway is quite a significant public player. So how, like, and let's be honest, like, kind of responsible for a pretty amazing standard of living over there in a lot of ways. Like, so how does this argument unfold over there?
I mean, it's definitely not a popular demand, you know, over here. There's definitely it's a hard sell. I mean, you're right. Like, the oil lobby here is crazy how infiltrated they are into like every section of society. Like, it's really very interesting. And they're, you know, they're sponsoring like every type of cultural arrangement. I was actually like I was emailing like the head of the Norwegian Football Association, because I have a court case for that football thing in a week. And
right,
I want to present in court like the amount of money that Equinor is giving to the Football Association, because I want, that's like, you know, that's a reason why I think it's right that I should be able to do a protest at a football game.
So you asked how much?
Yeah. And like, he wouldn't tell me, obviously. But then I just like checked his previous employment history, and is like, you know, worked in Equinor. And it's like, yeah, that with everyone. But basically, I mean, it is definitely a very hard sell here, because the whole, you know, like, there's a whole generation that's grown up with just an incredible standard of living. But the thing that we're trying to communicate in Norway is the fact that like, there's so much investment going into new oil infrastructure, and it's basically betting on a future where no country is like reaching the climate goals. So if, you know, if Europe does actually manage to reduce their dependence on gas and all that stuff, then Norway's going to be left with all these, you know, this just stranded infrastructure. So, which, you know, is going to be really bad for the economy. So that's the argument we try to present here. And I mean, even here, the Climate Change Committee released a report in October, which basically said that we should have a halt on new oil licensing because of those reasons. You know, like, we need to focus our investments in other stuff, or else our economy is going to be nowhere, you know, in 30 years. And the government just turned around and were like, nah, we don't, you know, we don't agree with it, so we're not going to follow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that seems to be the kind of prevailing mood right now, doesn't it? I mean, that, yeah, pattern's been repeated all over. Obviously, you alluded to the kind of oil and gas license situation in the UK, didn't you, as well? And again, Labour have just kind of torn up one of their pre-election promises, haven't they, of like putting, you know, huge resources into a Green New Deal as well.
Yeah.
So what do you think about, because obviously like in our little world, like sort of moving in a bit more closer to home, like with the snow industry, and, you know, like, how do you think about the way that the conversation is carried out in our world, like with the very obvious, you know, incongruity of ski resorts and travel, and, you know, like a lot of the like consumerism, the products that we all consume, and like on paper it's not Yeah, you know what I'm getting at. Like, how do you think? What's your view on the way that we kind of engage in this conversation in our little world?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I definitely, I find it definitely quite difficult to really engage with a lot of the communications that come from the outdoor industry on climate, because it just feels like it's sort of, you know, just like, oh, buy this product, it's good for, you know, it's good for the environment, and then we're kind of good, we're, you know, we're okay. And it's this, I don't know, I just find it quite unrealistic. It's not based in like a reality. And also this focus on, you know, climate change is like just going to be bad for skiing. I don't really buy this at all. I don't think it's a very motivating thing. I know me personally, I am motivated by like the fear of like the future. And I think the outdoor industry could do better, I think, to communicate climate change as something other than just, you know, a few less days at the ski resort.
What could that look like then?
I think, you know, more along the lines of the way that, for example, Just Stop Oil are communicating, which is, you know, talking about, you know, really how serious this is for the global south. It's I think that is a it's important, I think, to think of this as something more than just, you know, a few less ski days.
Yeah. Do you think like one of the things I've been thinking about a lot recently is intent and like even whether people understand. So I'll try and expand like on what I'm thinking about. So obviously I've been doing loads of stuff around the Big Sea, like you'll probably know.
Yeah.
And last week on LinkedIn, for my sins, a triathlon wetsuit brand were like, hey, we've just invented this revolutionary new product, which is like a biodegradable wetsuit. And they were like, really, like, you know, here we are, like, we're the leaders, like, we're this, that, and the other. And I sort of took one look at that, and I know quite a lot, I'm quite well informed about this whole conversation now, and I was a bit like, I just interviewed the guys behind Ulex, and in that conversation I asked them about limestone neoprene, which is the classic sort of surf industry kind of greenwash. It's like, oh, we make our wetsuits out of limestone neoprene, and the impression that they give is that it's like this natural thing that and it just isn't natural at all. It's like an incredibly toxic and damaging process. And so the guy from Ulex had basically said to me, yeah, like, you know, that's this, yeah, it does not stand up, like the idea that that's environmentally friendly. So then I see this wetsuit brand and they're like, and I was like, that's obviously limestone neoprene. But they'd given it this like fancy name, like Terraprene, I think they'd called it. So I just on the comments was like, is that limestone neoprene? And then because me and like Chris and Demi from the Big Sea had commented on it, like then I think, you know, LinkedIn people see it. So like quite a few people that I recognize from listening to the podcast and stuff all started commenting, and they got a bit caned, you know, and they came back, fair play to them. They did answer. And they were like, we do realize this is quite harmful. And, but we're just doing our best. And like, you know, like basically there's no Ulex tri suits that are fast enough. They were talking about the fact that they're not performance enough, you know? So I was a bit like, was that just completely disingenuous? Like, or do they actually think that they are doing something groundbreakingly sustainable? Like, I couldn't really work it out because from the way they were talking, and it was obviously marketing, you know, they were basically like, we are like pushing the envelope of sustainability, you know? And I do wonder if a lot of people in our world, like to borrow Erin Sahan from Donut Economics' phrase in the purpose industry, I do wonder if they genuinely do think that they're sort of the conversations that they're driving around things like, you know, kind of what you alluded to, the sort of like, we should act on climate because it'll mean we can go skiing more. Like, do you think it's genuinely something that people think is an important contribution to the debate? Do you think that it is a bit like we're doing our bit? Like, do you know what I'm getting at? Is it like a gap? Because I often look at that and think it's quite a gap between like the rhetoric and the actual impact of this, really. You know, I've got no doubt that everyone involved is incredibly well-meaning and really passionate and like really believes in what they do. But the question I always come back to is like, you know, what's the intention? Which brings me to like the triathlon people, like, and what's the impact? Like, you know, what actually are you doing? What are you achieving? Like, do you, I wonder what you think about that in the context of this, the way these conversations are held in our industries.
I definitely think you're right. Like, I think that a lot of, like, most people who are doing this stuff, they genuinely believe that that's, you know, they're doing their bit and it's important. And I think a lot of the issue, I think, is that people just don't really know what else to do. You know, it's just like, it's a given that, yeah, you know, we should, you know, promote the fact that we're, you know, have a few less emissions in our jacket or that kind of thing. And I can give you an example. Like, I was on the phone the other day to like a World Cup skier, and it was very interesting because like he was basically just like, yeah, I don't know what to do. Like, I want to do stuff, but I don't know what to do. And his first thing he kept on coming back to was like, you know, we just need to, you know, we need to show the positive thing, and we just need to make skiing the most sustainable sport, and we need to promote that and show this. And I was just like, no, you know, that should be a given. Like, skiing, that should just be like a straight up given, and you shouldn't need to communicate it. But what you should always be communicating is like the political stuff. Like, how can we use our influence and our impact to influence politics? Because that's, I mean, that's like the thing that I was, example I was like kind of giving him was, you know, if you focus a lot on the communications around like, yeah, we want to make skiing, World Cup skiing, like net zero and all this stuff, I just find it a bit disingenuous because, like, you know, they're like flying all over the world and stuff. But I think there needs to be more honesty. So if he was to, for example, just go out and say like, you know, yep, I fly all over the world, it's my job, like I have to kind of do it to make a living. But if, you know, politicians in Norway got their act together and actually could, you know, organize a night train from Oslo to Copenhagen to connect in with the rest of the night train service in Europe, that would make a massive impact, because then I could, you know, actually take the night train to the Alps and go to the events there by train. But I don't know. I just, yeah, I don't think people are really aware that that's something they can do. They just like automatically go to the kind of, oh, we're trying to just reduce like the impact of the way that we do things. And that's kind of like, that's it.
Yeah. And I think it's quite similar with, you know, we're all guilty of it, but it's just interesting, isn't it? You know, like in terms of how, you know, come back to the water protesting, like whenever it rains in the UK, people are always sharing like screenshots of the Surface Against Sewage app with like little turds around the UK. But then when there's a protest, 30 people, you know, like when they, yeah. I think people feel like, well, by sharing that, that's I've done my bit. That's that done now, you know, like that's me contributing to the climate kind of discourse, really.
Yeah.
But without actually thinking like, well, what could I do here to sort of have an impact? Like, what would that actually look like?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it also, like, a lot of it comes down to just people not really willing to stick their neck out. Like, it is just quite scary, I think, for people to, especially brands. I've been asking quite a few brands like to support direct, you know, to support like direct action and that kind of stuff. And it is like, you know, it's just so scary, I think, for outdoor brands to be associated with that stuff and to feel like they might take a risk, you know, in getting a lot of hate from their customers.
But again, do you think that's like, that's a really good example actually, isn't it? Because, you know, one of the things that we've joked about in the past is like, through my work at ACM, one of the most common things I hear from brands that, that I have conversations with is like, you know, I'm always like, so what do you want to get out of your market? And they're like, we want to be the new Patagonia, you know. But by the sounds of it, you've had a few conversations where you've potentially signposted a way that Brand X could actually do a bit of that. Like, because whatever you think about Patagonia, they certainly put their money where their mouth is with that stuff, with that direct action stuff. And then it's like, whoa, no, can't do that. Like, because you've had some experience of that, right, where you've suggested things and brands have just run a mile, basically, with the thought of actually doing something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I've had brands, like, say, you know, we want to be the new Patagonia. And then, like, as soon as you start trying to present some, yeah, for example, like, communicate around direct action, they're just like, oh, no, this is, you know, this is too much. But I think it's just generally, I mean, I think that's also just... goes to the rest of society too. It's just, it is just quite scary to put your neck out and support things which might be controversial or, you know.
So how have you ended up in this path then? Like, given everything that you've been talking about, like what's led you, like, where did your interest in this come from? And like, where did you, what was the path that took you to the point where you have ended up getting arrested and very much sticking your neck out?
I think it goes back to, I mean, yeah, I've been, you know, like snowboarding since I was a kid. And of course, then through like, you know, Pow and Jeremy Jones and stuff, like I've obviously then got like really interested in, I got very interested in climate change, like, as an issue when I was, I don't know, 18, 19 or so. And, you know, studied at a university and all that kind of stuff. But I think for me, it goes back to like when I was a kid. I mean, my dad has been like a campaigner in Scotland for his whole career, basically, and was like very closely involved in, for example, like the Right to Roam legislation and lots of other like campaigns. And for me, it was like I have seen very closely how a small group of people can go up against like an entrenched power, like such as like the landowning interest in Scotland, for example, and actually, you know, win and put through this legislation, which like for me as a, you know, I grew up basically being like a direct beneficiary of that legislation, which gave us like the right to roam. And as I don't think many people appreciate, at least in Scotland, how much went into that campaign, like to get this legislation. But as a kid, I was like, you know, seeing it very close up, all the stuff that my dad had to go through, along with others, to push that through. So for me, I definitely then, you know, was like very inspired by that, and it led me to, but like it was very like it's been a very slow process for me to go through. I've also gone through that whole stage of like, oh, I just need to reduce my emissions, that's what I should do, and I should promote this to other people, and you know, if enough people just take the bus to the Alps, it's like we're gonna solve this problem. But yeah, just over time I just realized more and more and more, this is like, it is about entrenched power. And it's like, you know, really it's about, it's a political issue, and we need to change like the political weather. We need to make it safe for politicians to feel like they can support like not giving out new oil licenses, for example. But I think for me, I really, yeah, I just did a lot of reading up on like disruptive activism, basically. And I got very, you know, for me, I got very like depressed a few years ago, just always reading these science articles about how bad the situation is and all this stuff. But then when I would read these social science articles on, you know, the history of disruptive protests and stuff, I would get a lot from that, because I could clearly see that there are ways to go up against like entrenched power. And I think, yeah, just learning about all these different campaigns in the past, using these tactics of disruption to basically, you know, because the thing with doing something disruptive or like civil disobedience is that it kind of, you, like the authorities, they have to roll a dice every time you do some kind of act of civil disobedience. The authorities have to like kind of roll a dice to how they're going to react to it. You know, they either let it happen and then more people are maybe keen to join and you make it easier for others to join because there isn't so much consequence, or they repress super hard, which is what we're seeing now. And then you get like public support because people are like, you know, what the hell? Why are they putting people in court for walking for 2 minutes, 47 seconds on the road? So it was really, for me, just very much about like learning the history of this kind of activism. And yeah, just feeling like it was something that actually can work to change the politics.
So it sounds like your recent experience is kind of, you know, given you more determination almost to continue down this path. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, 100%. That's the thing. Like when you go to court with other people who are also like in the same boat, you know, you discuss with them and you get inspired by them. And yeah, just being in court and like facing the, you know, you're really up close to like this, the, you know, this system, which is kind of trying to criminalize you. I got very motivated by that, to be quite honest, and really felt, yeah, like, oh wow, this is, you know, this is working. If they're trying to repress us so hard, then, you know, this is a good thing to do. And it was pretty like it was like actually a really cool moment for me, because my dad, like, he actually came down to London and helped me in court. So there's like a thing that you can do in the UK courts, which is called a McKenzie friend. And it was like kind of set up along a while ago for like kids who were in court, that they could get help like from their parents basically. But now you can use it as a kind of a tactic, because it's really useful to have someone else just sit beside you and like pass you notes and just have two brains sort of working on things. So it was really a super nice experience to have my dad there, and for him to be able to use his like experience from going to court and doing public inquiries and that kind of thing to help me. And I think he really enjoyed it himself.
Wow, but he was really proud.
Yeah, maybe. He's definitely supportive.
So with, you know, everything that you've learned, all the experiences that you've got, you know, clearly, as we've been talking about, there's an appetite amongst, if we bring it back to our little world, like there's an appetite for brands, for organizations to have an impact. Like, you know, we had a brief discussion about whether people are being disingenuous or whether they believe it. And I, for what it's worth, I think people do genuinely believe like in what they're trying to do. Like I've certainly like had plenty of conversations with brands over the years where there's clearly like good people who want to like contribute to this conversation. Do you feel like, is that something that you'd like to explore a bit, like the way that potentially you could help with that, like almost find this middle ground between the kind of direct action that clearly is, you know, is probably not something that most brands are going to go for, but also the kind of action that we see in our industry that you're perhaps not that convinced by? Like, do you think there's a different way that we could be having this conversation in our world?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely think that the outdoor industry in general could help a lot with this kind of normalizing activists and telling the stories. You know, I was like giving you the example the other day of these two guys that climbed the bridge, the Dartford Crossing. It was in 2022, I think, where, you know, they put a banner, just a oil banner up on a bridge for like 40 hours, and they got put in jail for like 3 years and 2 years, 7 months or something each, like ridiculously long jail terms. And that was totally political. But yeah. I was thinking, you know, I've been thinking like, why, you know, that could be an interesting story for the climbing community, for example. And it would like normalize it in that community, and you could go a bit deeper into the story. And I think that's true for a lot of the outdoor industry. I haven't seen any brand that's really taken on this thing of like disruptive activism over the last couple of years. And I think it would be a really good way to show that these people that are doing this stuff are not just like totally crazy. And I get that a lot, you know, people are like saying to me, oh, because they think like, oh, someone that's running onto a football game, like they must just be like a crazy activist. And I think it's quite funny for people to then talk to me and they're like, oh, you were that guy that ran onto a football game. Like that's, you know, that's a bit surprising. So I definitely think there's an appetite and an opportunity for the outdoor industry to tell these stories more, but also just like get more political. I really think that they're, you know, I've been saying this before, like the Greenpeace and stuff, they do not have people with a million Instagram followers. Whereas like the outdoor industry, we have, you know, I have friends that have like hundreds of thousands of followers on Instagram, and it's such a powerful tool to get a message out and influence people. And I just think we could be using it in a more effective way, you know, that power.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even, because when you said like get more political, you're already talking about outcomes, but I don't even think it's like, I just more think you have to ask the question, what is effective? Mm. You know, what am I trying to achieve? And is my means of trying to achieve this actually effective? So if we go back to our friends at the triathlon brand, I've got no doubt that they all sat around and were like, yeah, we should really try and do something sustainable. Like, and you know, not because like we, that would be great marketing. Like that's always like a nice byproduct of it. But I genuinely think people are like, are interested in this stuff and feel like it's important. But, you know, what they've ended up with is like a product that the collars don't match the cuffs. Like it doesn't, you know, the results don't match the rhetoric. Like, and that seemed to come as news to them. You know, they were a bit like, oh, wow, fuck, these people are telling us this isn't. So I guess I just, the more and more I think about this stuff and asking questions is almost the point at this stage. Like, you know, what do I want to achieve? It might even be like, I want to achieve like cleaner water at my surf spot in Brighton, or it might be that I want to produce like a genuinely sustainable wetsuit, like whatever it is, or it might be like you, like I want to reduce the power of fossil fuel companies. Like I just think like, is going to the Blue Earth Summit actually going to achieve that? I would probably question that personally. Like could you actually like just ask the question, like what could I do that's actually going to get me there, rather than just be like, oh, I'm going to become a B Corp, or I'm going to release a limestone neoprene wetsuit, or I'm gonna, because that's what everyone does, and that's what, like, just kick the fucking tires, like ask the question, mm-hmm. like is it gonna work this, you know, like. And I think ultimately that's what a lot of activism comes down to, isn't it, really, you know, just kind of bit of prodding.
Definitely, like, yeah, I totally agree. Like I think it really is about just, yeah, asking more questions and just being a bit more maybe critical and thinking a bit about what we're doing right now and whether it is like, whether it is effective. And also I think really like talking to people, especially like if we're thinking about climate stuff, like talking to people in the climate movement, you know, these are the people on the ground and they're like, you know, really in the trenches doing this stuff. And I really see, I don't know if the outdoor industry is, you know, talking to these people and actually asking, you know, like what should we be doing, like what is the most effective thing. So I would like to see more of that, but I agree with you. I think it is, and I think like for me, I automatically, I'm, you know, like I go automatically to the sort of like, oh, we need to get political and like and change something. But I think that's just how I am. But I like, I really,
well, that's your outcome, isn't it, you know, that's your thing. And as I think one of the themes of this conversation is that like everyone's going to have a different view on this. Again, the Bozell thing was quite clear, not only from Chris and Gav, but also, like, you know, if you ask Chris and Gav, like, they would both say they're really concerned about the environment, like they're really concerned about the climate crisis. But everyone's got a different way into this. Everyone's got a different, and you've got your take and you've got your approach and you've got, and you're quite clear about what you think action and outcome looks like. I think there's too often people just focus on the action part without worrying about the outcome part, just thinking like, well, if I share that story, like that's enough, isn't it? Like, but what, yeah. So it's an interesting point, isn't it? Really? And I think, like I say, because you're actually, I think you used the phrase like sticking your neck out, like you've literally done that, and you've clearly thought about this a lot. And from our conversations, I just found your perspective on this really interesting, you know, because it is quite a rarity, I think, that people are like getting in our world, getting involved in directions this degree.
And I actually find it a bit strange because I think it's right up, like, I think like direct action stuff is right up the street of many people in the outdoor industry, like action sports, because it's like risky, you know, and it's about like getting you plan this thing, this action, and then you try to tell a story around it. It's like a little bit similar to how we do things, you know, like doing trips and trying to tell a story around a trip, getting and all that kind of stuff.
Like you alluded to, like, your point was we have a voice, and we're really good at brands, especially when it's what they know about selling product. They're pretty fucking good at talking about that, you know. So I think what you're suggesting is, why don't we just shift a little bit of that focus towards this in a slightly more effective way, right?
Yeah, you know? I also think it's funny because, like, one of my good friends here in Norway, who, like, we're doing a lot of activism together, she's like a really good skateboarder and grew up skateboarding, and I kind of joke with her a bit about the fact that, like, I think we are kind of drawn to this thing because, like, when you're growing up skateboarding, you, like, you know, you just fail, like, so many attempts to do something, and then, like, finally you get it and you're like super happy, and then you go back to like trying another trick, like fail. And I think that's what we're doing with all this activism stuff. You know, it's like, it's such, like, in most of the time, like, kind of brutal work. You don't really get a win, and then you get one win and you're like, okay, nice. And then you go back into the trenches. And I think it's interesting to think about. I think many more people in the outdoor industry, if they actually kind of read up on the history and got into the stuff, they would be into it.
Yeah. Well, I always really enjoy talking to you about this, Callum, so thanks for doing today. Much appreciated.
I'd be interested to ask you, like, you've been doing a few different things, like, for example, the Patagonia documentary you're working on. Like, how have you felt it's been to take, like, a critical look at, like, companies in the outdoor industry, or, like, just the industry itself? Like, how have you felt that they've been, it's been to take,
like, it's been it's been really interesting. I mean, I've been working on that for a year now, and I think, I mean, a lot of that's just because I'm quite busy with other stuff, and they were very graciously didn't give me a deadline. but it's been super interesting. I mean, I've just tried to approach that as like a really even-handed piece of journalism. You know, one of the reasons that I wanted to make that documentary about Yvon Chouinard giving the company away is because of the reaction, actually, because of the way it was discussed online. Because, you know, at the time, this was September 22, I think, and as is often the case, it just became a very binary conversation. You know, there was either people that were saying, like, oh, what a hero, like, you know, he's given up his company to save the world. And then there were people that were like, well, it's obviously like a tax dodge, or there's some angle. Like, it just immediately devolved into that. And I just sort of looked at that and thought, well, it's pretty obviously not that straightforward. Like, you know, like there's got to be more to this than that. Like it's a kind of culmination of their sort of corporate campaigning over the last 25, 30 years. And it's obviously a story about legacy and he's an old man. So what's going to happen after he's dead? And that was kind of the starting point of it, really. So I just, you know, as you probably know, because you listen to the podcast, now, I do try and approach these things quite even-handedly. So that's just what I've done with that, really. And what's been really interesting is like, yeah, I mean, I certainly wasn't approaching that as like obviously I've got a relationship with Patagonia. So it's really important to me that it wasn't some like PR whitewash, just like, hey, this is brilliant. You know, like my view is that you have to look at these things critically. You have to look at these like as a grown up, you got to ask questions. So I've just tried to approach it like that. And I think what's been really interesting for me is like, it's only really now that I finished to actually understand what it's about, like, and it's really helped me understand this conversation a lot more. And that's been a really nice process. Like, you know, for me, I run a marketing agency that works with brands. You know, like, so my work is actively involved in selling products. Like, and so is everybody in this game. At the end of the day, like your mates who are sponsored. They're only sponsored because it's perceived at the brand that their profile will help shift more products. Like that's just the fact of the matter. So for me, like I'm aware of my role in this, like kind of, you know, capitalist society. And I try and reconcile that by the work that I do away from that, essentially, you know. And I do think that's a big theme of the announcement as well. I do think a big theme of it is like a big part of what Patagonia have been grappling over the years is that conundrum, you know, and what they've obviously decided to do is like use the profits that's generated by that for good. And that is an increasing theme in the corporate world. Well, I mean, it's not even a new theme. It's a theme that's been around it's philanthropy at the end of the day. Like that's another huge theme of the documentary. Like, where does this fit into that? But I guess my point is that, like, I don't really have a problem keeping those things quite separate, like at this point. And I think for me, it's valuable to understand these conversations and my own view on it. And think about that, how that can inform what I do for a living, which it certainly is, you know, and it certainly is having an impact on that. And I think it will change that in the future. But I think that's, you know, we're all going to be grappling with that at some point. You know, you're grappling with it, like everyone's grappling with that. So I've found it super interesting. So yeah, it's timely. I just finished the third episode script yesterday, in fact. So the end is in sight.
I just think it's interesting because you're definitely someone that's like opening up, you know, different kind of conversations in the outdoor industry. And also, like, you know, I think it's important. I said this to you last summer, but, you know, for me growing up as a snowboarder in, you know, early 2000s, like the only kind of idea I had of snowboarding was this classic Monster Energy and, you know, like park riding and helicopters and all this stuff. And it's been very formative for me to actually, like, through, you know, this podcast, to understand that, oh, there's like people that are doing these sports who are thinking about all this other stuff and using their love for the sport to actually make change in other ways. And it's like actually been really, really inspiring for me, you know, to have that influence over the last like few years.
Well, that's really nice to hear, man. But I mean, I've just always felt that I just was never convinced that was the only interesting thing about surfing, skateboarding and snowboarding. From an early age, and maybe that's like absolute narcissism because that's what I was into. But I just always found, even from the days when I worked at White Lines, like I just found the one noteness of it, if I can put it that way, like just totally weird. And like, cause like they're a great activity, but they're just a way of looking at life when it comes down to it, aren't they? You know, like, and you don't have to just pinpoint it, like you say, to that one area, which the whole industry seems to be generally fixated on, and I never quite got that really, because for me, I just never understood. I just always thought, well, there's so much more stuff we could talk about around this, these topics. So that's really nice to hear. Thanks, I appreciate that. Yeah, nice. So how's your week looking? Are you more riding?
I don't know. It looks like the weather's changing a little bit. And it's Easter here in Norway, which they take very seriously. So everything closes down, all the shops shut and everything. So probably I'm going to work the first part of the week, but then yeah, go to a cabin or something. I have a court case next week, so prepare for that a little bit. Try to
win. There you go. Week in Callum's life. Easter court case, cabin. Nice. Well, thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate it. So there you go. That was me and Callum McIntyre, and I hope you enjoy it. I will say, actually, Callum fucking rips. If you follow him on Instagram, then you're going to see that. I'm just going to quickly look it up. This is golden podcasting from me here. What's his address? It's Housekeeping Corner. Come on, we can do this. Callum McIntyre 5-1-L-M-A-C-T-Y-R-E at the end. Callum McIntyre 5. He is on Instagram. You can follow him there, and you can get very envious about the snowboarding that he's doing in Norway, and you can find out more about his direct action exploits. I'd love to know what everyone thinks about the topics raised in this one. If you do want to let me know, you know what to do. You can leave a comment over at Substack or on Instagram, where you can find me at We Look Sideways, and feel free to share it with anyone you think might be interested in this. So, Housekeeping Corner. And I want to remind everybody about the new Housekeeping Corner discount club that I've just launched. Amazing discounts from brands such as DB Journey, Goodrays and Vivo Barefoot. I'm also talking to other friends of the show such as Finisterre, Albion, Stance, Liquid Death and loads more. Head on over to either www.wearelookingsideways.com or lookingsideways.substack.com. You'll see a button there that says HKC Discount Club. Hit that button. You'll find all the details. It's pretty simple. It involves exclusive discount codes that you put in at checkout and you get discounts. That is it. No catch, no signups. All right, that's it for this week. I'm off to France in a day or so. Quick Easter visit, only going for 5 days, which means I've got a to-do list a mile long, so I better go before Boog skins me alive for pissing about on this one. I should be packing. I'll be back soon with another free creative exchange session, actually. This one with Kepa Acero and Tim Myers. But in the meantime, I'll see you next time. Nice one.